If you're looking for a podcast to give you ideas for recipes on what to do with that leftover Easter ham.
Oh, well. Yeah, no.
Basically, no. Sandwiches. Sandwiches would be my suggestion. However, this is not that podcast. No. This is, however, comedy,
tragedy,
marriage. Welcome to Comedy Tragedy Marriage, a podcast where a longtime married couple takes turns each episode selecting a movie, TV show, or documentary to watch. We watch it together, then we sit down to discuss why we liked it, loved it, or loathed it, and share that discussion with you. I am Stan the Movie Man. I review films occasionally. It's been a while, yes. At stanthemovieman.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Movie Man Stan. You can follow the podcast at CT Marriage. You can also follow me on Spoutable, Blue Sky, and on Threads at Stan the Movie Man. If you have a suggestion for something you would like us to watch or a longer form question that you would like to pose to us, or if you just want to rant and rave at us for some reason, you can do so by sending us an email, comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. You can also send us a voice message by clicking the link in the description of this episode. Joining me as always is my other half,
Maud the Royal Broad.
And it was Maud's choice this week, and her selection was
the 1961 religious epic King of Kings. We typically watch our films on Sunday afternoon or evening, and this past Sunday was Easter, and so I thought a religious epic was in order. The 1950s and early 1960s were sort of an era where there was a rash, I guess, or a boom in religious epic films. They were, you know, widescreen formats, 70 millimeter, CinemaScope, yeah. Technicolor, things like The Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. And this one from 1961, King of Kings. Now, let's go down to the cast because it's large. It starred Jeffrey Hunter as Jesus, Siobhan McKenna as Mary, Jesus' mother, Herd Hatfield as Pontius Pilate, the governor, Ron Randell as Lucius of Cyrene, Vivica Linfers, as Claudia Procula, Rita Gamm as Herodias, Carmen Sevilla as Mary Magdalene, Bridget Baslin as Salome, Guy Guardino as Barabbas, a young Rip Torn as Judas Iscariot, Frank Thring as Herod Antipas, Guy Rolfe as Caiaphas the High Priest, Royal Dano as the Apostle Peter, Robert Ryan as John the Baptist, Edric Connor as Balthazar, one of the three wise men, Jose Nieto as Gaspar, another one of the wise men, and Adriano Rimaldi as Melchior, wise man number three.
It was a cast of thousands.
It was a cast of lots. Now, we have some uncredited cast members as well, including Ray Milland, who was the voice of Satan in the scenes where Jesus is baptized and then he goes out into the desert for 40 days to be tempted of the devil, where he doesn't eat or drink anything. Ray Milland is the voice of Satan that he hears. And an uncredited Orson Welles as the narrator of the film. And for someone who we never see on screen, Orson Welles is probably the most present character we encounter throughout the film. Now, the movie opens with Emperor Pompey entering Jerusalem in 63 BC and sacking the city and entering the temple to seize Solomon's treasure and massacre the priests. But he finds in contrast to, you know, the gold and jewels and all of the things that of material value that he was expecting to find inside the temple, all he finds is the scrolls that compose the Torah. Now, Pompey holds these over a fire until an old priest reaches for them, and then Pompey gives the scrolls over to the priest and leaves to rape and pillage and massacre and steal from surrounding villages and towns. Now, years later, there are rebellions that break out against the authority of Rome, and the Romans crucify a lot of the leaders and place Herod the Great on the throne of Judea. Now, at this time, a carpenter named Joseph and his wife Mary, who is great with child, arrive in Bethlehem because they're going to the city of their lineage for the census. They obviously, according to the Bible and the movie, which they agree here, they can't find, there's no room in the inn. So they end up staying out in the stable. Mary gives birth to Jesus. He is in a manger. Shepherds have followed the wise men or the magi to gather to worship the baby Jesus. The wise men arrive with their gifts. As per the Bible and the story, the Lord warns Joseph to not go back home. They go to Egypt for a while to keep Jesus safe from the massacre of the innocents. King Herod hears about this new king being born, and he feels threatened, and so he says, you know, let all the newborns in the vicinity, newborn boys, you know, let them be murdered. So that happens. And Herod the Great dies, and he's actually killed by his son, Herod Antipas, who then takes over the throne of Judea. This film kind of slips and skims over a lot of, like, the biblical account of the life of Christ. But there are some pivotal events that are portrayed. We see the baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist. We see John the Baptist saying, you know, answering the crowd's questions, because they've been looking for their Messiah, thinking that he's going to be a political leader to, you know, get them out from under the thumb of Roman rule and oppression. John the Baptist explains, I am not the Messiah. I'm just his, you know, his precursor and his messenger telling you to, you know, make straight in the desert a highway for our God, because I'm not him, but he's coming after me. I'm not worthy to even untie his shoes. John the Baptist and Jesus, according to biblical tradition, are actually cousins. John's mother, Elizabeth, and Mary, Jesus's mother, are cousins. And so John the Baptist and Jesus are related. We see in some detail that in Jerusalem, Herod Antipas arrests John the Baptist for his preaching. And Jesus comes to visit John while he's in prison. Judas leaves the rebel Barabbas, Judas does, and joins Jesus and his apostles. And Jesus begins his preaching ministry, and crowds start to gather, including Pontius Pilate's wife and Lucius, who actually, I don't remember a character named Lucius ever being mentioned in the Bible anywhere. But anyway, there's a scene where Salome does, you know, her dance. And the story in the New Testament goes that John the Baptist goes to jail because he is preaching and calling Herod and Herodias, his wife, out because Herodias had been Herod's brother's wife, and so that relationship is forbidden, and Herod doesn't like being called out like that, so he puts him in jail. Herod's throwing a big party in his palace, and he wants Salome, his like stepdaughter, I guess, to dance for them. And he is a drunken lich, and he's like, "I'll give you anything. I'll give you up to half my kingdom." And Salome, urged on by her mother, says, "I want the head of John the Baptist on a silver platter. If you'll give me this, I will dance for you." So she dances. John the Baptist is beheaded, and that's a whole thing. Moving forward, we do see depiction of Jesus with his disciples at the Last Supper, and he breaks the bread and passes the cup and says, "Take and eat, take and drink, do this in remembrance of me." And Judas goes off to do his filthy betrayal. We see his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane and the kangaroo court that ensues after that, which is all part of, the grand plan that culminates in his crucifixion and resurrection. There's a lot of creative and literary license taken in this film, and I don't really know where the producers and director got their material from. I don't know if it was all like the Bible and they kind of monkeyed with that to sort of make their movie, or if there was research into other historical sources such as Josephus and other secular historians of the day whose accounts of the person of Jesus and his life and ministry and acts and things that he did. I don't know if other historical documents were consulted in the making of this film. But a lot of just as okay, full disclosure, I am a believer and I read the Bible on the regular, and I have read the Bible on the regular for years, and so I'm pretty familiar with this story. And there are things that we see in the movie that a lot of license is taken. Mostly it's just that important stuff is kind of just glossed over. Not to really spoil anything, I mean, there are some lovely elements to this film. The musical score is gorgeous, and there is a recurring theme that occurs in many of the instances where we are encountering the figure of Jesus. That's in the musical world, that's known as leitmotif, where a particular theme of music accompanies a particular character. And that is used to good event, to good avail in this film. The score is lovely. Miklos Rocha did the score, and it was lovely. This film was, I'm looking for, it was directed by Nicholas Ray, written by Philip Yordan, and uncredited writing by Ray Bradbury. Who'da thunk it? There are places in the film where instead of seeing Jesus like in the flesh, we see his shadow. And I think that is used effectively as a device to sort of get us to pay attention in a different way. It puts me in the mind of types and shadows, where we have types of Jesus in the Old Testament and shadows foreshadowing his coming and his ministry and the ultimate end and resurrection. So there's a lot here.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a...
It's a huge, epic production.
It's an almost three-hour movie.
It's a lot. We say that a lot lately about a lot of our films, but it's long.
Well, it is, but, I mean, there's a lot they left out as well. Usually, the thing I noticed is when we see Jesus in shadow, he is performing his miracles.
Which makes sense.
When he's making the lame...
When he's healing.
When he's doing his healing, the blind to see, we only see him in shadow. Mm-hmm. We see his shadow cross the blind person's eyes, and we see somebody who's laying in a bed and whose limbs are all gnarled up.
Their limbs unfurl and they're able to walk.
And we just see his shadow cross over them. Of course, they leave out the two best known miracles, which is water to wine and bringing Lazarus back to life.
His first miracle was water into wine, and raising Lazarus from the dead was huge, of course.
But neither of those is in the film.
Which is an odd choice.
Especially the Lazarus one. Water into wine, okay.
We didn't even see Lazarus or Martha in this film at all.
And I realize, you know, you got to cut some stuff out. And, you know, he, as you pointed out, a lovely white blue-eyed Jesus.
Yes, with a very bad wig.
I didn't have any problem with the wigs so much.
The wigs were all... Anybody that was wigged, the wigs were bad. The fake facial hair was bad.
Well, you know.
That's... Obviously, those things are not where the budget went.
Yeah. You know, there are some people of color film.
And there's a lot of brown face.
There's some brown face, but there's also... You know, most of the people of color are either slaves or servants, and a lot of them are, you know, Italians, because I think a lot of this was shot...
In Italy?
In Italy, I think.
Let's see.
It was shot in Spain, as I recall. But, you know, the story is modified quite a bit. One of the most obvious modifications is the connection between Judas and Barabbas.
I think they made that up.
Yeah, well, as far as we know, there was no connection, at least in the Bible stories that I'm familiar with. Barabbas is not even mentioned until the trial, when the crowd says, "Give us Barabbas." And Judas has been a disciple, you know, since, you know, he's just one of the disciples. You don't know, at least from what I've read, when he joined.
Yeah.
But in this movie, King of Kings, they know each other. They are compatriots. And Barabbas is fighting against the rule of Rome, trying to free Palestine. And, or the Holy Land, depending on how you want to look at it. And, Judas was working or was supporting him, working with him, and leaves to go with Jesus. But Barabbas is leading this group of freedom fighters against the Romans. And that's, you know, he gets captured, and that's what eventually leads to his being released. Now, Judas, it isn't just greed in the film that leads to Judas turning over Jesus to the trial. He thinks that if he forces Christ's hand, that he will then use the power that he has as the Son of God to wipe away the Romans, wipe away their control of the Holy Land, and you know, remove them.
That political Messiah that they were looking for, that political savior.
Well, they weren't...
To save them from the tyranny of Rome.
I don't think they were looking for a political Messiah. They were looking for a general to lead them in battle against the Romans. That's what Barabbas wanted. And, you know, Jesus preached love and peace. And that's not what Barabbas wanted. And when it looked like, I mean, Judas thought, at least in the movie, that he could make Jesus turn into this force of violence against the Romans.
This military figure.
By turning him in. But that's not how it worked out. Which leads Judas to hanging himself.
Which we don't see.
Which we don't see. We see the aftermath of it. You know, and to be honest, I liked that connection between those two.
Well, it's literary device.
Yeah.
It's just there's no evidence for it.
Well, no, there's not.
At least not in the Bible.
I'm talking about how it works in the movie. Not...
Yeah, it's a good plot point.
Whether it is biblically accurate or not, I'm not talking about it in that sense. There's a great deal about this movie that is not biblically accurate. But there is... I'm just referring to what works in the movie and what doesn't.
Yeah, and what drove the plot, and it was a good plot point.
That particular thing was a good plot point.
Yeah.
That's one of the few things that I found enjoyable in the movie.
The portrayal of the Sermon on the Mount was good. Jeffrey Hunter as Jesus gets a good chunk of face time here, and he delivers, you know, the Beatitudes and other pieces of the Sermon on the Mount narrative, and that was effective, I think, and beautifully shot and beautifully portrayed by a white, blue-eyed Jesus.
Yes.
I remember asking you during the movie, I'm like, Jeffrey Hunter played Captain Pike, right?
Yes.
In the Star Trek pilot?
Yes.
And
Cage.
I'm like, okay, I knew him.
Yeah. He did, and I had to look it up because I knew there was a Tab Hunter and a Jeffrey Hunter.
Yeah, totally different people.
Two different people. But I just wanted to make sure that Tab Hunter hadn't played.
Was not Captain Pike.
Captain Pike, and he did not.
Leadership roles. Interesting.
Yes.
Typecasting because he was very handsome.
Yes.
And these are the days where Hollywood wanted handsome leading men. They, in these religious epics, they wanted, you know, handsome biblical figures. They wanted a beautiful Jesus. They wanted a beautiful, handsome, charismatic Moses in the Ten Commandments. These religious epics were quite the phenomenon in Hollywood for a while. Big, splashy, huge casts. The budget for this film specifically is estimated to be between $7 and $8.5 million. Its box office was almost $13.5 million. Which I don't know in, you know, 1961 money, is that break even? Is that make a profit?
Well,
is that big budget?
I don't, well, I think, yes, that's big budget for the time.
Yeah.
And as far, you know, the business is completely different than it was back then.
Oh, sure.
You know, they didn't have the sort of promotional budgets that they do now, but they also didn't have the kinds of pre-sales overseas. And I don't know, is that a strictly American, North American box office? Is it anywhere else?
Yeah, how's it? Know? What are the metrics for it?
I don't know exactly how it according to a magazine from the time, the film was considered a moneymaker at the British box office in 1962.
Interesting. Okay.
So I'm guessing, yeah, but it was considered a financial success. But like I said, the business is totally different now than it used to be.
Yeah.
So
it was distributed by MGM. Roar. It was released in the fall of 1961 on October 11th at Lowe's State Theater. It was it premiered on October 12th in Los Angeles, and then throughout the states on October 13th. Running time is listed as 160 minutes, excluding the overture, intermission, and exit music.
Yes.
It's long. Plan your fluids, grab snacks. This film, in contrast to a more modern day film, such as Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, this film is like a 30,000 foot sort of overview. We see the high points, some of them, whereas Passion of the Christ focuses very laser focused on passion, crucifixion, and we don't have a lot of, you know, the larger big picture overview stuff. It focuses on the main event more. This film flummoxes me. I had not seen it before. I had perhaps seen bits and pieces of it here and there. And there are things to recommend it, but it's a little bit of a hot mess.
Yeah, it is.
It seems disjointed in places.
Yeah, it's also kind of a slog.
It's long, yeah.
But that is
That's what an epic is, though. It's a huge film.
It's a 21st century opinion on a mid-20th century film.
Yeah. The genre of which is really, we don't see anymore.
No, we don't. I mean, the closest thing, I suppose, you would get to this, I mean, granted, they're completely, completely different, would be Oppenheimer.
It's an epic of its sort.
Yes. And it is slow. And, you know, could 20, 30 minutes have been cut out of it? Probably.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I'm not a filmmaker, so it just seems like a lot of it drags. There are scenes with Herod, the second Herod, in his castle that seem sort of unnecessary. There's a lot of stuff between the Roman soldiers and, you know, the governor that seems unnecessary. There's even the stuff, you know, you know, showing Jesus and the apostles walking through the countryside, which gives Orson Welles an opportunity to do the narration, but that also seems a bit unnecessary. He's just basically reading the Bible verses
at that point. Not so much.
Okay.
There's a lot of that narration that takes a lot of license.
Okay. Well, yes, also with his pronunciations. For instance...
Oh, not just that.
Well, but he says...
Is it Barabbas or Barabbas?
Well, he says Barabbas when he's talking about Barabbas, and he says apostle with a T.
Which is...
A hard T.
Foreign to modern day ears, but I don't know what they were talking about in the 60s.
It's wrong. It's just wrong.
Well, and there are people who
specifically insisted on saying apostle.
Really?
Yes.
Well, he was a little precious.
He was real precious.
The character, you know, is her name. I'm used to hearing Salome. Is mm-hmm. it Salome or Salome? We hear both things. It just kind of missed the mark, kind of for me.
Yeah, it's an investment of time, and while I believe we saw it was streaming for free on Tubi, it does have commercials, which adds time.
When you go pee and get a sandwich.
Well, that of course, usually the commercial breaks on Tubi are only maybe a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes.
So then you hit pause, you go pee, make a sandwich.
Yeah. But you know, there's plenty of time to hit pause. Even if you rent it from someplace, like we did, we rented it from Apple Movies. But it's like, yeah, it's a lot. It's really a lot.
It's a lot.
And it isn't entirely worth it. I mean, I guess for the experience of having seen it, for it being this giant...
extravaganza.
Cast of thousands, biblical epic from the 1960s. Okay. It does not, you know, rank up there with the Ten Commandments, which used to be like every Easter we would watch the Ten Commandments in my house.
Now, see, I've never seen the Ten Commandments all the way through.
Well, you started with that one, and then you decided to go with this one.
Well, and then I was like, well, what about the greatest story ever told? And then, you know, it's like there were several Easter Sunday religious epic choices for me to pick from. And I picked this one. And so this is 3 hours and change of our lives that we'll never get back.
Well,
and
160,
I'm glad
160 isn't 3 hours.
I'm glad to have seen it. It's not an experience that I feel like I will wish to repeat.
Yeah, I don't see us going back to this one.
It's not awesome. It's not terrible.
Right. It's very middling.
It's middling.
It is very...
Which is sad to me, given the subject matter.
True.
But you know,
bad movies can be made about great people.
And great things. It happens all the time.
Just the same way that great movies can be made about terrible people.
True.
So, what do you... what rating do you give King of Kings?
Oh, gosh.
And you won't be struck dead for if you don't give it a good rating.
Three and a half dunks into the River Jordan.
Yeah, I think 2.5. For me, it's just so much, and
it's okay for me, dog. It's just okay.
Yeah, it's a little pitchy. It's just It is so languid in its pacing, and yeah, there's plus the overacting and the scenery chewing,
spitting splinters.
Yeah, it's there are a few good things that I enjoyed about it, which are against, you know, that are things that aren't in the Bible, which maybe says more about me than about the movie.
The costumes are cool. The score is great.
I don't care about that.
The color and the scenery are lovely. It's okay.
It's very middling as far as I'm concerned.
Time magazine didn't like it at all.
Yeah, 2.5 for me.
It's all right.
What else have you been watching, reading, listening to, all that good stuff?
Okay, so over the weekend, I was doing a library catalog search at work on Thursday, and I stumbled across an author I didn't know named Anne Maugh, M-A-H, and she is a food and travel writer, but she had written a novel in 2018 called The Lost Vintage. And so I read the synopsis and I'm like, okay, this sounds like a good storyline. I'll give this a try. Over the weekend, I devoured this thing. It's the story of a woman who lives in the States. She's a sommelier. She is studying, viciously studying, to get her Master of Wine certification, which is a huge deal in the world of wine experts, enophiles. She has a heritage in France where a cousin of hers and his family still live. So she, her restaurant gets closed, and she decides this is the time to go back to the Burgundy region of France, stay with her cousins, help them with their harvest, which is known in France as the vendange. And so she says, how about I come over, help you, stay with you in the house, you give me my room and board, I work for you during the harvest of, you know, this year's crop of grapes, and cram for my test. And so she goes over there, and part of what they want her to do is help clean out the basement of this home that's been in their family for several generations, right? So she and her cousin's wife go down into this, you know, dark, musty, infested basement and start cleaning out things, and they start finding some very interesting artifacts from the World War II era. Things that belonged to her great aunt. Some clothing, some boxes of papers, that kind of thing. And so this book bounces back and forth between present day and World War II, and they stumble across a huge secret. And so there's a bit of mystery involved. There's the rekindling of a romance that ended 10 years prior. There's family dynamics. There's, themes of Nazism and anti-Semitism, and a lot of very knowledgeable tidbits regarding food culture, wine culture, and Ma's knowledge there is, you know, very evident in the writing of this book. And I devoured it like the food that was mentioned inside the book. It was glorious. So look for Anne Maugh, M-A-H. Look for The Lost Vintage. She wrote another novel in 2022 called Jackie in Paris, which I think is a fictionalized retelling of Jacqueline Bouvier's time in Paris when she was a young unmarried student. So anyway, that was glorious. I also have started watching a Peacock original production based on another book called Apples Never Fall. It stars Sam Neill and Annette Bening, and a cast of several others who are prominently featured as their children, and one actor who is this mystery character, Savannah. and it's a murder mystery kind of situation based on the book Apples Never Fall by Leanne Moriarty, which I have placed on hold and should be arriving in my hot little hands very soon. So I want to read the book, hopefully as I watch the series. So I'm hoping to kind of read and watch concurrently. But so far, the episodes of the series have been very compelling. I am all in for it. So that's been very cool, and I like it very much. So what about you, Stan?
Well, you've been watching that thing on Apple TV, Palm.
Oh, yeah. Palm Royale. Okay,
Yes.
so I've had several people in my socials, and even my brother recommended Palm Royale to me on Apple TV. It stars Kristen Wiig and Carol Burnett. Bruce Dern has had an appearance so far. Laura Dern, it's delicious guilty fun. It's based in 1969, West Palm Beach, and or Palm Beach rather, and it's the story of this girl from Chattanooga who was like a small-time beauty pageant queen, and her marriage into like the last legs of a wealthy Palm Beach family, and her overwhelming desire to be accepted into Palm Beach society and be somebody. Allison Janney is delicious as a rich bitch, old money, hateful heifer. And Leslie Bibb is also involved in this. And I'm like, I kind of didn't recognize her because I'm used to seeing her with blonde hair, but she's a brunette in this thing, and she's also part of the country club set. That has been, as I said, a delicious guilty pleasure. So I'm caught up with that, and apparently from now on they're just going to be dropping episodes. I think maybe one at a time per week. So it's very good, and I recommend it
Okay.
on Apple TV.
You and I watched the first episode of The Three Body Problem. You were not all that into it.
Was okay.
That is on Netflix. I would like to watch more of it. Of course, it is the latest hotness from the guys who brought you Game of Thrones. It is based on a Chinese novel about strangeness. It's science fiction based. And I know so little of the story that I'm not even going to try to recount it because it wouldn't do it justice. But needless, I will say that some very smart people, some physicists and the like, have recently turned up dead, apparently by suicide, and they have died. They have killed themselves in strange ways,
And it seems to have a lot to do with this weird, funky VR helmet thing.
maybe.
Yeah. It's what it looks like after the first episode, anyway.
So, and a detective who is washed out of various services. And is on his last chance, is trying to figure out what's going on. And the universe has just winked at Earth. So that's how the first episode ends. So that's called The Three Body Problem, and it's on Netflix, and I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of it. I watched a movie on Hoopla, which is a service you can get, free service. That you can get just by having a library card. A movie called Appointment with Death, based on an Agatha Christie book. It stars Peter Ustinov, Lauren Bacall, Carrie Fisher, John Gielgud, Piper Laurie, Haley Mills, David Soul, and more. It is a Hercule Poirot mystery. He is on holiday, Wherein he runs into this bourgeois American family, a stepmother and her children, or her stepchildren, and the stepmother dies under what appears to be natural causes, but Poirot thinks it was murder, and he works on the case for the rest of the movie. It's not the best Hercule Poirot movie I've ever seen. It is very late 80s. It was 1988. It has a very saxophone heavy score, which really does not work for a movie that is set like in the 1920s.
But it was made in the 80s.
It was made in the 80s, so it has a score that will remind you of L.A. Law.
And it's that's pretty heavy-hitting names in that cast that time, too.
It's got a great cast, but it's fine, especially since you don't have to pay anything for it.
It's fine.
But there are better ones. Ustinov's Murder on the Orient Express is a good version to watch. I prefer it to the one that Kenneth Branagh did. Anyway, I watched another thing on Hoopla. It's a documentary called The Found Footage Phenomenon that was a production by Shudder, the horror movie channel. It is a look at how the found footage phenomenon sort of takes care of itself, influenced horror movies. While it sort of got its modern start with the Blair Witch Project, it actually goes back further than that. And what we think of as just, horror movies, oftentimes are actually talking about bigger societal topics than just trying to scare you to death.
Yeah,
so,
a guy I used to work with was all about the social consciousness of horror.
Yeah,
as a genre and what it was really trying to speak to.
Yeah. So that is on Hoopla. It's called The Found Footage Phenomenon. And I went to the movie theater to see Late Night with the Devil, starring David Dastmalchian. If you don't know that name, you would know his face if you saw it. He played one of Ant-Man's friends in the Ant-Man movie, the first Ant-Man movie. And he's always on the fringes frequently of various films. He played the doctor who puts the poison gas pill in the mouth of the Atreides, the Duke, in the Dune Part One. I know that was a word salad that didn't make any sense, but if you've seen the first movie, you know who I'm talking about. But in this film, David Dastmalchian plays a talk show host back in the late 70s who is going up against Johnny Carson. Things are not going well for him. For one thing, he doesn't have that much of an audience. He's a syndicated talk show. And on top of that, he's just lost his wife to cancer.
Oh, man.
He's trying to think of something, anything, to bring in ratings. So on Halloween night, he is going to do this Halloween-themed version of his show with a guy who, talks to spirits on the other side and connects them with their family members, and a skeptic who's going to come on and debunk all of that, and a woman who, a parapsychologist who is working with a young woman, like a preteen or early teen, who was brought up in a cult.
Fun show.
Well, and this this young woman allegedly is possessed by a demon, and the parapsychologist has her so that she can talk to the demon when she hypnotizes her, puts her in a hypnotic trance, and the madness ensues. And it's a really well done kind of lo-fi film that just explodes in the last 10 minutes.
Oh.
And it's in limited release. You may not be able to find a theater where you are. It's only playing in one theater in this town where we live. And I had to drive across town to see it.
Aww.
But I thought it was fantastic. Now, it is also a Shudder co-production. So perhaps in the near future, it will wind up on Shudder. So if you subscribe to that service, or if you have AMC Plus, you may be able to see a edited for TV version of Late Night with the Devil. But if you can get into a theater and see it, I highly suggest you do, because it is fantastic. And if you can take as big a group with you as possible or see it in a full theater, I think that will add to the experience as well. Late Night with the Devil, currently in theaters, but I don't know for how long. And if you can see it in the theater, that is where I really suggest you see it. Okay? Do you have anything else?
I don't.
All right. Well, that takes care of it for this week. Now, I already know what we're going to watch next week, so I'll go ahead and tell you now.
Ooh.
Jordan Peele, who was part of the comedy team of Key and Peele, has gotten into directing films in the last decade or so. And he is primarily focused on the horror or unusual genre. And his first outing won him an Academy Award for his script. And that movie is called Get Out. And that is what we are doing next week on Comedy, Tragedy, Marriage. It's not supernatural. There's no ghosties. Nothing at all like that. So, that's the extent of what I'm going to tell you. So, that's what we're watching next week on Comedy, Tragedy, Marriage. So, thank you very much for listening to this edition. Please join us next week. And if you would be so kind as to share us with your friends on social media, give us a follow, rate, review on whatever podcast platform you found us on. And if you do that on Spotify, that helps us a lot. If you would also be so kind, let's see, I already did that. And if you have something that you want to suggest that we watch, a movie, TV show, or documentary, just send us what it is and why you think we should watch it. Send it to comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. I'm Stan the Movie Man. That's Maud the Movie Broad. Love you.
Love you.
And until next time.
Later.